on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Welcome to Tuesday afternoon on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk to Representative Mike Zaleski, House Chairman, Committee Chairman, holding a hearing a little bit later this week on sports gambling in Illinois. He says it is a race. We're racing with Indiana and Iowa to get things done. So we will talk to him about that a little bit later. But we start things off on Tuesday with John Najarian. You see him on CNBC and, of course, from the Najarian Family Office. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Great to be with you, Stephen. Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to start with the Barry Manilow song. It looks like we made it. S&P.
Yeah, fun. It looks
like it's all behind
exactly.
us, Fred. We did it. We weathered the storm.
Now, do you know the movie that song was from?
I do not. What was the movie?
Foul Play.
Really?
With Chevy Chase and Goldie Hawn.
I was going to guess Chevy Chase. That's right. Wow, looks like we made it.
Yeah. It was a great flick. Anyway, to your point, yeah, we finally did crash above the old historic highs. And now the question is, do we set a closing high? We certainly are holding on to the momentum that we picked up just in the first hour of trade, and it's just continued to build.
And so, you know, I thought coming into this earnings reporting season that there was some concern and trepidation that maybe the signs weren't going to be so good. The bad signs have not materialized, have they?
No, and in fact, it was exactly that trepidation, fear, pessimism that basically set the bar so low that the companies are able to not just step over it, but in some cases leap over it. There were people that were saying Kohl's, for instance, KSS, big retailer. Mm-hmm. There was a very large short interest. Those are people betting against the company that have sold stock in hopes of buying it back at a lower price. They were caught flat-footed when Kohl's announced that they're going to be accepting Amazon returns at all of their stores. In other words, they're going to handle a lot of that return part.
Right.
For them, and that's huge because it brings people into your store.
Obviously. Right, so that means it doesn't have to be through Kohl's, or I could have purchased anything on Amazon, and I can return
exactly.
it to Kohl's, which brings me into
yep.
Kohl's, and I'm not going to leave empty-handed.
Right, it's just like when you know a place puts a gallon of milk on sale for $1.99 or something
right.
like that, and people say, well, that's a lost leader. Yeah, it is, but it brought you into the store, and then you're going to spend more money.
Right, I leave with six packs of Oreos to dunk in that milk, something like that. I'm following a couple of relationships. I'm worried about Princes William and Harry in England, because apparently they're feuding, and also the on-again, off-again romance with President Trump and Harley Davidson. It seems like they're dating again.
Yeah, well, you know, initially, you know, it was a real all-American brand that you could see why a guy that touts Make America
sure.
Great could easily push for that. And then when they more or less went against, at least his view, not against America, but it went against his view of what it meant to Make America Great, and they said they were going to make motorcycles overseas, he was very unhappy about that. And that's when that, you know, rift started.
Right.
And apparently now the bromance may be back.
I mean,
you're right.
He had even urged a boycott, right, of Harley Davidson.
Yeah, he encouraged people to buy all the other motorcycles. And there are some, but they're not nearly as
right.
big a production, of course, as Harley.
Which brings us
to Victory and Indian.
Brings us right. today where Harley talked about how they had a 27% drop in the first quarter profit. They're blaming in part the tariffs, but also the taxes that the EU is imposing on them. And that's what got the president's attention. And he is promising what? Some sort of retaliation for the EU taxes?
Yes, he is. And, you know, that could be partly why You know, the Queen, I'm sure you saw this, reported it already, invited the president and Meliana over to for a 3-day state visit. And, you know, that's only the third U.S. president to do that. The other two, I think, being George Bush and Barack Obama, that were accorded that meeting with the Queen, not just going over to meet with the prime minister. And maybe that's part of it. Maybe they're trying to head off both some of the negotiations that are going to happen if Brexit does indeed happen, along with perhaps trying to make the relationship a little nicer.
I was listening to someone this morning, a Brit. Oh, it was Piers Morgan. So whatever you think of Piers Morgan. But he said he does not think Theresa May will be prime minister by the time the president visits Great Britain.
Very possibly. And again, that wasn't the invitation wasn't from her, but
sure.
I think, you know, she's already offered up her resignation if they would have voted for the last Brexit deal she put out. And even that wasn't enough of an enticement for the parliament to vote for it. So I think her days are numbered there.
Let's talk about some of the positive reports we've seen. You know, my friends at Twitter, the thing about Twitter was they were never able to increase their user numbers, and it looks as if they've got some nice user numbers and they're seeing profits on Wall Street.
Yeah. I think a lot of what they have done in terms of trying to limit some of the bullying on there, I still say, Stephen, it would be far easier if Steve Bertrand had his Twitter account and it was that was your name.
Right.
Just like it's my name on Twitter. But having anonymity allows people to be more bullyish, if that's even a word. And I think Twitter has tried to address it other ways. I think that would be a relatively easy way to address it. But nonetheless, those numbers were very impressive, to your point. And the stock exploded higher by about 15-16% today.
Oil prices are up near a six-month high, and this comes not long after the president or the White House announced that they were going to not extend waivers to countries, some U.S. allies, buying Iranian oil. What do you think that's going to mean for the cost of oil down the road?
Overall, I think it'll be met by higher productions here in the U.S. This was partly what happened, Stephen, as you recall, when we crashed from $77, $78 per barrel of WTI. When we crashed, it was because people didn't think the president was going to issue waivers. And when he put the sanctions back on Iran, and instead he did issue waivers to Japan. So that meant that, yeah, they can't just sell it on the open market, but they could sell it to Japan. They could sell it to China, two very big buyers of energy. And when that happened, that really caused a glut then, because everybody ramped up production to meet what they thought would be a 2 million barrel shortfall.
John,
so that's something that they don't want a repeat of that.
All right, John Najarian, what are you watching today? What are your suggestions?
Well, we were actually buying Avon, AVP. It's a relatively cheap stock. It's $2.60 or so. And there was a lot of upside call activity, and so we ran along with that. We'll probably be in that trade anywhere from a month to 3 months.
All right. We'll talk again next week, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
I'm thrown by all the music. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. And, well, you know, you can count on Wintrust. One of the things you could always count on in Chicago was Stanley's Fresh Produce. I had been standing on the near north side for, well, the shop has been open for more than 50 years. I don't know that it's always been there, but abruptly they were open on Easter Sunday and then on the Monday afterward, gone. Ryan Ory wrote about it in the Chicago Tribune. He's a business writer, and he joins us now on the Biz Lunch. Ryan, welcome back.
Hi, good to be here.
You know, it seems to me like, and I was joking yesterday when your column first was posted online. You know, when I lived in the city and not too far from there, every year or two I'd get on a health kick, and all of a sudden I was going to eat nothing but fruits and vegetables, and I would go to Stanley's because it was sort of inspiring, and that's all you could buy. I was really surprised to read that they just shut down on Monday.
Yeah, it's surprising in that they do have such a big following of loyal customers, and they've been there so long. They did kind of telegraph that this could be coming last year when they put the they put their property on the market for sale. And so I think people have kind of been watching to see what's going to happen. But it was the closing was very sudden, you know.
I guess that's it, right, because I'm thinking, why would a shop be open on Easter and close the day after? Why wouldn't they just bag it, you know, stay closed on Easter Sunday?
Yeah, you know, what the family said was they were still trying to line up some sort of financing to keep the business going up until, you know, Sunday night, and that, you know, once they realized that wasn't going to happen, they just never opened again. So, you know, it sounds like the employees and customers and everyone else had no idea that the closing was that imminent. I think, again, because they put the property on the market for sale last July, people have sort of, you know, been preparing themselves for something's going to happen here. But
right. Well,
but even so, I mean, even though they knew it was you know, likely to be sold at some point, I think it's still, you know, there's still people, a lot of people who are pretty sad at the news yesterday that it was you know, not going to open again.
Well, it was quite a picture that you painted with your words yesterday about how they were working into the night just to try to stay open, which is interesting to me because it seems like, you know, I'm interested in the motivation for their effort to do that. If the money wasn't there, if they weren't making money, why they tried to keep it going. Did you get any read from that?
No, they didn't really explain too much about that. You know, I mean, they did talk about, you know, they've been hurt by competition from larger larger stores. Like, there's a couple new Mariano's, for example, that have opened in recent years that are within a pretty short drive of there, and they said they've been, you know, losing revenue because of that. But, you know, just from the eyeball test, I mean, I shopped there, and it still seems like they were doing a good business, and there were a lot of people there, but they said that overall their numbers were down, and that they were trying to, you know, figure out how to keep it going for the time being. But, you know, in the meantime, again, they've had the property up for sale. They think it's going to be sold and redeveloped at some point, and, you know, long term, it didn't seem like this was, you know, this was going to be around.
That's kind of the macro story of it all, isn't it? I mean, I teased coming into this, like, did Mariano kill Stanley? Because, you know, in a way, back in the day, if I wanted Jicama, I had to go to someplace like Stanley's. Now I've got Jicama for days, every direction I fall. You know, the produce has changed a lot in supermarkets, the availability of it. And so I would imagine, you know, why would you go to a specialty shop where you can get it, where you're also going to get your frozen pizzas?
Well, I think that's a battle that they've been fighting, is these huge new grocery stores are really nice, and they have, you know, entire sections of, you know, meats and seafoods and produce, and they're kind of become one-stop shops, and so that's a challenge. You know, you can also order things online and have them delivered to your house, which you couldn't do a few years ago with produce. But, you know, the calling card they've still had, and the reason there's still a lot of loyal customers, is you can go in, if you're somebody who eats a lot of, you know, produce, or, you know, you have a big family or whatever, you can still come out of there with several bags of groceries for, you know, not a lot of money. And if you are buying several bags of produce at a traditional grocery store, that can get expensive pretty fast. So for a lot of people, it was still worth the effort to find the place.
The other thing, aside from the Mariano stores nearby, I mean, we talk a lot about the Lincoln Yards project on the show, and that is sort of at the back door, side door, front door of the Lincoln Yards project, right? So that land is going to be pretty valuable.
Right. I mean, the whole reason that that, you know, the days seem numbered was, you know, last year the owners of Stanley's hired a broker to put the property on the market for sale, and it's being billed as, you know, an opportunity to go to a very visible, high traffic corner, you know, knock down this single story grocery store structure and put something larger there. And so, you know, they said at this point they don't have a deal in hand. They don't have a contract to sell the building, but that they are actively talking with potential buyers and do intend for that to happen. And so, there is the timing of, you know, Lincoln Yards going into the area. There's some other development happening nearby, and part of that's a product of there was a very large a large area along the Chicago River where the city recently changed land use, what type of zoning is allowed for various projects, and so that spurred a lot of change in the area, and now, you know, now they have a chance to sell that property potentially for several million dollars, and they look at that and say, you know, we can sell, you know.
Yeah, that's a lot of jicama.
Right. So, I mean, how many pounds of produce, you know, would they need to sell to get a lump sum, you know, payment of several million dollars? So,
you know, I didn't think of it until we started talking, Ryan, though, but, you know, when Carson goes on sale or goes out of business, you know, you can go buy a T-shirt there at half price or whatever. Stanley's just closed. I'm assuming it was filled with fresh produce when it closed. What's going on with that food?
You know, at one point yesterday, they were actually briefly, you know, one of my colleagues was over there, and they were briefly throwing the doors open and basically just giving it out. I think they were trying to donate the produce to some some pantries and things like that. But yeah, I mean, obviously the problem there is most of their stuff is very perishable, and they've got a couple of days, you know, to figure out what to do with it all, or it's just going to go. Well, it's just going to be wasted. So I don't know.
I hope they found some good places for it. I'm sure they did. The city certainly isn't wanting for people in need. Ryan Ory wrote about this at ChicagoTribune.com yesterday. It's the front page of the business section today. Ryan, I appreciate you joining us. Thanks very much.
Sure thing.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, it is all about sports gambling these days. I know the legislature in Indiana is working on a bill. Of course, that's the case here in Illinois as well. Mike Zaleski is the chairman of the House Revenue and Finance Committee. They've got a hearing coming up on Thursday about sports gambling. Chairman, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
It's good to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, we're going to be betting on everything pretty soon, right?
I don't know about everything. We'll probably be betting on quite a bit.
And
it's an exciting time for Illinois. I hope we can get a bill done because it's going to mean much-needed tax revenue for the state and a safe and transparent marketplace.
Well, how much of this is a race? I mentioned that Indiana is in the process. Other states are as well. I mean, is it important to get something up and running before them, or does that really not matter so much because people aren't going to be traveling to gamble anyway?
It's very much a race. I think that it's incumbent upon us to make sure that Iowa and Indiana don't beat us to the punch on this. They both are working on pieces of legislation. We need to get ours done by May 31st, which I feel really good about, and we're making good progress on. So hopefully we can get this done and get it onto the governor's desk.
All right, so from what I read, you favor, I mean, there are several different models out here, but you seem to favor one called the New Jersey model. Is that fair?
Yeah, so New Jersey has a mixed approach. They use online and bricks-and-mortar casino sports wagering. That suits very well with what our current gambling environment is. Their tax rate's pretty reasonable. Ours is striving to be reasonable. They allow for affiliations between websites and bricks-and-mortar casinos and racetracks. So overall, they do a really nice job of blending a marketplace. I think that's what we should strive for.
All right, so you would have casinos in places like the racetracks. They would sort of house the gambling operations, but then they could have a couple of online presences, right? So that I could bet from my smartphone sitting in this studio, say, through a riverboat casino or through a racetrack.
That's 100% true. Okay. Absolutely.
How many people are actually going to go to a racetrack to bet on sports? It seems to me like they're all going to be using their phones.
You know, it's a good question. I think that the racetracks and the casinos, too, it's going to be incumbent upon them to up their marketing game a little bit and make sure that they're providing content to the consumer and make sure their place of business is a desirable place to go. Another thing I think is important is we don't want this online to go out too far too fast. So we want a little bit of a physical presence, at least initially, and we can go from there.
I think I saw somewhere that in New Jersey, 80% of the sports betting is already online on your smartphone.
New Jersey's had a really good rollout of their online platform. Again, that's something we should strive for, and hopefully we can get this done.
All right, so I bet on the Sox game. I win $100. How much of it does the state get under your plan?
The state would get approximately. It depends on the tax rate. It would depend very much on what we decided an appropriate tax rate should be. It depends on very much if we should tax the total amount wagered versus the amount of income that the gaming industry makes off the bet. But I think in global terms, it could be anywhere from a fully mature market could be anywhere from $40 to $60 million.
Okay, but I'm just talking about my 100. If I win the 100, do I get all 100 back in the housing, the racetracks, the casinos have factored in the tax and they pay the tax, or do I get taxed on my winnings?
You would get taxed on your winnings. Okay. Most likely you would see a small percentage go to the casino for an administrative fee to house the bet. We've been told that the tax rate is very much commiserate with how much you would get taxed on your winnings, but we're trying to be responsible and consumer-friendly in how we do that.
What I know, there's another plan that would allow the Major League Baseball or the Major League Sports franchises or leagues, I guess, to get a cut of this. And they're saying that, look, people are betting on our product. We should benefit from that as well. That seems kind of hinky to me that Major League Baseball would be benefiting from online gambling. But what do you make of that?
Yeah, I understand your point. I understand the controversial nature of the league's involvement. What I would say is this. It's very difficult, I think, in Illinois when you have four successful sports-owning families, the Ricketts, the Reinsdorfs, the Wirtzes, and the McCaskies, to simply tell them, we're not going to allow you a place at the table. The Ricketts have invested a large amount of money in Wrigley Field and the surrounding area. The Wirtz and the Reinsdorfs have invested money in the near west side of Chicago. So they're stakeholders, whether we like to acknowledge that or not. So what we said is come to the table, be good faith negotiating partners with us. We will hear what you have to say, and we'll go from there. There's been no sort of commitments made and no decisions have been made, but they're very much stakeholders. We don't want them to oppose a bill in Illinois.
Sure.
So we're trying to work it out, and I think we've had a really good process so far.
Well, so do you see where I could be sitting at Wrigley Field at a game, and then up on the big scoreboard there would be a betting line as to whether Anthony Rizzo hits a double his next time up? I mean, is it going to be that blatant?
I don't think it would be that blatant. I do think the leagues would tell you that they have mobile and app abilities that rival those of casinos and traditional gaming. And I think that they would tell you they're technologically savvy enough to make this a robust marketplace. So, if you went to that ball game and bet on whether Rizzo would hit that double, you would probably have a phone in your hand. But I don't know that it would be on the scoreboard.
And we're talking about the At-Bat app, right? The Major League Baseball already has up and running. They would funnel gambling through there, maybe?
I don't know if I can go as far as to say it would be through the At-Bat app. I do know that they very much invested in their online platforms, their advanced media platforms, and I think they really do see an integrated platform of you entertaining yourself through the app, watching the game, and wagering on it. I do think that's a realistic scenario that they envision.
All right, so this hearing coming up on Thursday, you're going to hear from colleges, right? Altogether different from professional sports. Colleges, I would imagine, have some concerns as well. What do you expect to come out of that?
Well, in other states, they've banned the bets upon in-state college games. We actually see some value in that practice.
Chairman, value in allowing the bets or in banning the bets?
In banning the bets.
Okay.
We think that young collegiate athletics athletes could be prone to forces that professional athletes may not. We want to hear from the athletic directors and see what they have to say.
All right, and so that's coming up. What else is in the hearing Thursday?
There's a lot of sort of what we would call back office suppliers, okay. Technology offers of technology related to sports betting that want to hear their voice on this, want their voice to be heard. We're going to hear from them as well. We're going to try to figure out the best way to integrate them into the bill. We're going to hear from local governments. They want to know if they're going to get a piece of any revenue from this. So we're going to have a collaborative process on Thursday. We're going to try to write the best bill we possibly can.
Is the House leading this, or is there a sort of a competing effort in the Senate?
we're working collaboratively with Senators Link and Munoz in the Senate and the governor's office. I wouldn't say there's any one leader on this. It's been a really good process so far. This is one of the governor's top legislative priorities, so we're really trying to get a bill to the desk as soon as possible.
Mike Zaleski is the chairman of the House Revenue and Finance Committee. Thanks very much. We'll talk again soon.
Take care, sir. Bye.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Have you been at your job now waiting for a higher-up to retire so you can swoop in and take their job as you climb your way up the corporate ladder? Well, pump the brakes, because it's not quite working out that way these days. There's one little problem. Older Americans aren't retiring. Retirement-age workers now make up 20% of the workforce in the U.S. That's one in five American workers that should be off somewhere in Florida. But money manager company United Income found in the report that this is the first time this has happened in over 57 years. Know what that means? More competition. And that's also true in the apartment game in Chicago. The market is flourishing, with building owners making big bucks. Crane shared a story of JAB Real Estate that bought an old Logan Square church and converted the 11,000-square-foot building to apartments. But now the building's up for sale, and they're listing it for double at what they bought it at. Talk about being crafty and seeing an opportunity. Or they just prayed a lot. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:52. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, here on 720 WGN. Well, he's made it out of the PPG Paints green room and into the studio, the Allstate Skyline studio. Kelly Leonard is here. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Host of the podcast, Getting to Yes And, which it drops every other Tuesday or every
yep,
Tuesday?
Every Tuesday. Every Tuesday.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so in this edition, you talked to Bill Wooditch.
Right.
Who is a risk management guy.
Yeah, he's a CEO of the Wooditch Group, and he's got a new book called Fail More, which seems odd from a risk management guy.
Right, right. But so, we talk about this so often, about failure and how important it is, and yet failure is something we should be trying to, well, I would think we should try to avoid failure and let the message over and over is that not really, you should almost embrace failure.
Sure. Well, we
encourage failure?
Well, it's how we learn,
okay.
Right? You learn from your mistakes. You don't really learn a lot from your successes. And unfortunately, there's such a high premium put on getting it right the first time. And this goes back to our education and SATs and all that. But in business, and what most business leaders realize is that the way they got good was by trying a lot of stuff and failing. And they know this in like Silicon Valley in terms of product design.
Right.
We know it at Second City in terms of the kind of what it takes to get great ideas on stage. You have to burn through a lot of bad ideas. And so Bill is a really interesting guy, successful CEO, makes a ton of money, and he's out there spreading this message. And he's got a great line in the book. He says, failure doesn't mean your efforts are over. It means they have just begun.
So the failure is the beginning.
Yeah.
Overcoming the failure is the next step.
And it takes what he talks about is a growth mindset. And this comes up a lot in the books I'm reading, all the current business books. There's a professor named Carol Dweck, and she coined this term growth mindset. And it's really the opposite of a fixed mindset. People with a fixed mindset think things are good or bad. They're black and white. And people with a growth mindset are looking for maybe what's different and maybe what's gray about this area, and they're willing to take more chances, and they end up being more innovative than people who are in that fixed mindset.
Is the fixed mindset or growth mindset, are they innate or can one be developed?
No, they can be developed. That's the point of this, is that and many of my guests even coming up are talking about the fact that the brain develops differently for different people. So some people, are like this from the get-go, and other people are well into their 20s, like Bill,
right,
who didn't have a great childhood, didn't have a good business career to start out with. He developed later, and you got to give room for people to make those mistakes.
As we talk, I'm thinking of situations, not specific situations, but situations where people fail.
Yeah.
And we tend to, well, I was going to say it's a ridiculous word, but we look at that as a failure. We look at that as a shortcoming. We look at, that as rather than look at that as like a stumbling block.
Sure, well, look,
right?
At
we look at that as a defining issue rather than as an issue along a pathway, I guess.
Exactly. And if you look at someone like Steve Jobs, who everyone celebrates as the greatest innovator of all time, he had way more failures than he did successes.
Right.
But he needed to do those failures to get to his successes.
Yeah, I'm trying to sort this out in my head. You make me think sometimes, Kelly, a lot.
Okay,
but,
that's good.
Elon Musk, right, developed something, and when it's a catastrophic failure, when SpaceX fails, we tend to
brand them as a failure, right?
until they build the next thing.
Right, but we don't focus on that necessarily, but no. I'm sure that they are.
And that happens at work all the time. You know, it's this idea of kind of replacing, we talk about this idea of replacing blame with curiosity. So stop looking at someone of being like, you failed, so I'm going to blame you, instead of like, why'd you fail?
Right.
And can you learn from that? That's the more interesting mindset. It's the better mindset, and it's really what most innovative people, that's how they approach their work.
He says that certainty is brain candy. Explain that for me.
Yeah, well, this is a trap, right? Your success can be a trap because you think you know it all, and then situations change, and maybe you don't know it all, or you don't ask other people for their input. So really, we have to be very careful around people. It's the people who have the need to be right all the time. I mean, no one likes them, and so that's one.
Right.
But also, they probably aren't right all the time.
And so they are
obnoxious.
Yeah. There's none of them in this room, are there?
No.
Okay. Good. We're safe here.
We're safe here.
All right, so, what's your big takeaway from this one? What do you think we should be bringing home?
I think what we need to bring home is, especially with our young people, is we have to give them chances to skin their knees. We've got to give them chances to fail. Look at the bad grade on the test as an opportunity for someone to do better next time.
I was thinking when you said that, because, you know, people say, well, he took the ACT two or three times, and we're thinking, well, that's not fair. Well, no, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
That's the path of it. You fail the first time, or you don't do so well, and then you go back and do it again. That's not something wrong.
Yeah. No. That's how we develop and how we learn.
Kelly Leonard, the name of the podcast is Getting to Yes And. It's up at WGNRadio.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.